We've been in the midst of a teaching from Paul that's kind of extensive in scope. It's been covering many weeks and many chapters. And he's been telling us why he speaks boldly. And he tells us why suffering and other things that might look like weakness and defeat are not. They are not to have his word disregarded, but they in fact show a stamp of authenticity as he delivers the good news. So he continues with that "Why am I bold?" theme, and he does it with some very, very encouraging words today. Words that I find so encouraging, I couldn't help but let them jump into my opening prayer. So with that context in mind, let's listen to God's word as I read it aloud. I'm going to back up to verse 16 of chapter 4. "Therefore, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. Now, we know that if the earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God, an eternal house in heaven, not built with human hands. Meanwhile, we groan, longing to be clothed with our heavenly dwelling. Because when we are clothed, we will not be found naked. For while we are in this tent, we groan and are burdened because we do not wish to be unclothed, but to be clothed with our heavenly dwelling, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. Now it is God who has made us for this very purpose and has given us the Spirit as a deposit, guaranteeing what is to come. Therefore, we are always confident and know that as long as we are at home in the body, we are away from the Lord. We live by faith, not by sight. We are confident, I say, and would prefer to be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So we make it our goal to please him, whether we are at home in the body or away from it. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, and each one may receive what is due him. For the things done while in the body, whether good or bad." I've talked about national parks a couple times during the last couple weeks, and Lucas and I are on a bit of a national park documentary kick. So you'll have to bear with me a little bit. But we watched a TV documentary called Wild Alaska. And the final chapter of Wild Alaska was about what it takes to summit Denali. Denali is also known as Mount McKinley. It's the highest point on the continent of North America, and it's the namesake of Denali National Park in Alaska. Now, the interesting thing is that as you go up higher and higher and higher, there becomes less and less life. There are these cool worms. They're cold worms, as a matter of fact. But they're called ice worms, and they live where you wouldn't imagine that anything could live. Eating bacteria stuck in the ice, and no other living thing there. And so it's amazing because you don't expect to find them there because you find almost no life. But when you go higher than that, there's not even ice worms anymore. There's no birds. There's no mammals. There's no plants. There is nothing but granite and ice. And crazy humans that go to a place where nothing can live, and they try to get to the top. So they fly in, they get acclimated, and then they make a harrowing 3-day journey where they sleep in 3 different camps in tents as they approach the top of this mountain. Half of the people that set out did not make it to the top. And it's not because they did something wrong. If the weather does the wrong thing, you can't make it to the top. Half make it, half do not. I don't know if the right word is many. It's certainly not a majority, but a substantial number of the people that attempt this do not survive it. So we have people that are depending upon a tent, upon fabric stretched over some poles to make it possible for them to live where nothing lives. In this chapter that we just read, we find out that Paul tells us that is what we are. We are tents. Our bodies, strike an impressive pose. Our bodies are tents. They allow us to live in a place that we're only visiting. In the same way that that tent allows people to visit the path up to the top of the mountain, your physical body makes it possible for you to be what you are, which is a visitor in this world that is not your final destination. I had printer problems this morning. Corey tried real hard to take care of me, but I sent her the wrong file. So my research notes are here beautifully on paper, but my sermon is not. So we're doing it this way with this screen in front of me. To get the real context, we have to realize the drum that Paul is beating in this part of the passage. He says, we do not lose heart. He follows that up with, we are of great courage. And then again, he says, we are of great courage. He says, this is a reason for my boldness. There are reasons that I do not lose heart, Paul is saying. There are reasons that it's appropriate for Paul to have great courage. Yay, again, great courage. Now, it would be wise for us to understand what's keeping him from losing heart. It would be wise for us to understand why he can declare that he has great courage. Because as we live out lives in these tents, we have need for that. We have a need to not lose heart when things are hard. We have need to have great courage when there's things to be afraid of. So I'm going to talk about courage when there's nothing to be afraid of. Courage is moving forward undeterred by things that are to be feared. Verse 16, we do not lose heart. First reason we don't lose heart is because there is more than what our eyes see. Paul discusses how there is an outer self that is wasting away, but an inner self that is being continually renewed. We talked about this a little bit last week if you were here. If you weren't here, just listen and dwell. He declares momentary affliction are producing an eternal glory that is beyond comparison when it gets compared to that momentary affliction. Verse 17, for our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that outweighs them all. So in response to that, we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. Paul tells us right there in the verse, for what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. So what our eyes can see is temporary. Therefore, we fix our gaze, we focus on what we can't see with our eyes. Now, don't misunderstand that. That doesn't mean we invent some figment of our imagination and we live according to it. But as a starting place, Paul says, you're going to have to look past what your eyes can see and look beyond to something that is eternal, and he will define that for us. See, we don't lose heart because there's more than what our eyes see. We don't lose heart because if our earthly home is destroyed, we have a building from God. That's what Paul is declaring to us. We're now in chapter 5. Now we know that if the earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God, an eternal house in heaven, not built by human hands. He says that's what we have. We have that because God has promised it. Because God has promised it. So when we take our eyes that need to see beyond what is seen, what they are to look toward is the promise that God has made us. So we don't invent a future and grab hold of it. We don't wish for a better destination and start believing it. We receive from God, from the creator of the universe, a promise. And then we need to ask the question, can I trust him? Can I trust him? Can I trust him? If we can, and Paul declares that he does, if we can trust him, we can trust his promise. And that means we go forward with our eyes, the eyes of our mind, fixed on the reality of his promise, not in the obstacles that we see as we walk around. But it's anchored in him. It's anchored in his trustworthiness. It's anchored in his promise. In verse 2 and 3, he talks about our experience of this living in a tent, knowing of a better place. Meanwhile, he says, we groan. We groan. Do you groan? If we're on the side of Denali and the wind is ripping through the fabric and the poles are shaking, we huddle and we groan. And we say, please, God, even atheists say, please, God, let these poles keep me safe so I can see tomorrow. We groan. Paul tells us what we know. We live in a world that we groan. Because if we were here by ourselves with just this tent, it would be overwhelming. Paul says we groan, longing for the better. We groan, longing to be clothed with our heavenly dwelling. Because when we are clothed, we will not be found naked. We groan and long for the better. The removing of the tent, not the removing of the tent into nothingness. That would be what Paul is calling naked. If we think about the mountain climber again, if the tent is ripped away and the mountain climber is laying there on the side of the mountain with all of those storms pouring down on them, we would call him exposed. We would call him exposed. Paul says, no, we don't fear exposure. We're not worried about being naked if the tent is taken away from us. Rather, we look for something better. And God defines that is a heavenly home made by God himself that is to replace the tent. Because you see, there is a place that should be home. There is a place that will be home. Home is not the place you visit. It's not the path up the mountain. It's not the life we live here. No matter how comfortable we've made it, this is the place of a tent. This is the place we visit. This is not our destination. So we will not be found naked because the body to come is real and sure. He says we're not unclothed, but we're further clothed. If we look at verse 4, for while we are in this tent, we groan and are burdened because we do not wish to be unclothed, but to be clothed with our heavenly dwelling. To be clothed with that which is better. The heavenly dwelling, the new body, the one that's not temporary and described as a tent, the one that's made to be our home forever. He describes that as so that what is mortal being swallowed up by life. What is mortal? This body of death, this tent that will not last, this tent that wears out, being replaced, one body for a new one, one that will not wear out, that will last forever in the presence of God, where our home really is. Verse 5 says, "Now it's God who has made us for this very purpose, this new home." It's the purpose we were made. Even as he puts us in a tent, it's so we can visit. It's not our destination. "And we know it to be true because God has given us the Spirit as a deposit, guaranteeing what is to come." Now, a few weeks ago, we talked about that earnest money, the down payment on a car, the deposit that is the Holy Spirit. And here, Paul is making that promise applied to our new body as well. It is sure because a down payment has been made. Now, if you remember the conversation we had just a second ago, the question is he trustworthy? When he makes a promise, can he keep it? Paul says, oh yes. Not only is he just hypothetically trustworthy, he has actually placed down a deposit. So the promise is sure. Forever has already started, even though it's not fully here yet. The deposit's been made, the promise has been made, the promise is sure. That means obstacles that might stand in our way, even if that's what we see, do not deter us. Verse 6. "Therefore, we are always confident." Always confident. Another version, another translation of the Bible said, "always of good courage." This idea that's so closely related to not losing heart. Ready to move forward in the face of things that would scare us and the things that are difficult, of the very things that make us moan, makes us groan. That's where we live. We live in the world of groans. Lots of times we wish we didn't, but that is where we are. He says we can have this good courage, we can have this confidence, because while we live in the tent, we are very aware that there is something better. How do we know this? We know this because we walk by faith and not by sight. In verse 7, Paul declares, we live by faith, not by sight. Because of this, we are confident. It doesn't matter that our eyes can't see it. Our eyes of faith that trust simply ask, has the promise been made? Is the promiser trustworthy? When the answer is yes, and we trust the trustworthy promiser, who is God himself, we are walking by faith rather than by what our eyes see. He repeats himself in verse 8. We are of good courage. We are confident. Faith moves us forward undeterred by fear. Then he says, I would prefer to be away from the body and at home with the Lord. See, because of the promise to be away from the tent is to be in the presence of God. So Paul, to summarize, Paul says, because the tent is God's, it is good. And while death is scary, what comes on the other side of death, not because of the death, but because of who Jesus is and the promises he's made, is better. So the tent is good. What is next is better. Because if I leave this body behind, knowing the gospel, having it applied to me, then the destination of being with God is better. And Paul doesn't comment on the timing very much. But as we put all of Scripture together, we see and there is a magnificent body that is to come. So we're not leaving a body behind. We're moving from the temporary tent to the eternal home that is with God himself. So I say I would prefer to be away from the body and at home with the Lord. Reasons to be confident. Reasons to not lose heart. And Paul says, in light of all of that, he has one aim. And he invites us to share his aim. He says to you right now, come on in. Have this aim that's mine. Join me in this aim. You know, people attempt Denali, Mount McKinley, with one aim. They climb, carrying that tent and putting it up to sleep in it in freezing weather with one aim. The aim is to get to the top. If they're part of the half that don't get to the top, something in their gut says, oh, I want to try this again. I didn't succeed in my aim. The tent on the mountain is deployed with one aim. Paul says his desire is to use his tent, his body, that God has given him with one aim as well. And he defines that aim as to please God. Verse 9, and so we make it our goal to please him. Whether we're at home in the body or away from it. Whether we're in our tent or we're in what comes next, there is one aim, to please God. Now, why is that? It's because that's what we do with someone that we love. That's what we do. When there's someone that we love, we aim to please them. That's true of our spouse, if we're married and love our spouse. If God has blessed us with children, it's true of the way we relate to our children. We really do want to please them. And sometimes they're thinking, you what? You're trying to please me? Oh my goodness, this word does not mean what you think it means. If this was all about trying to please me. You know, sometimes we love poorly. You know, sometimes I don't aim to please Katie because I'm pleasing me. And that is not loving her well when that's the reason. So, engaged in the company, think about this. It's what you're signing up for. Sometimes we love poorly, and sometimes it just feels that way because there's something bigger going on. Okay? An example would be from parenting. I joke, my kids, you're trying to please me, you silly man. It doesn't feel that way at all. Well, you see, because I love them, bigger things than their pleasure are going on. But because I love them, I push them and I discipline them and I correct them because I want something better for them. That's what love looks like. So it's not simply pleasing them, but I never try to displease them without a bigger purpose. We try to please people we love. Now, with my spouse, sometimes Katie doesn't feel like I'm trying to please her, because something bigger is going on in that moment. And what God has told us is that He is bigger than our children. He is even bigger than our marriage. Sometimes what God calls us to do in pleasing Him will feel like we're not pleasing those other subordinate loves. And Katie will tell you, and I will tell you, a subordinate love is exactly what we want. Because she does not want me setting aside my love for God for her. That would be a horrible place. And I don't want her doing that for me either. You see, if we don't subordinate our love for each other to the love we have for God, the love is diminished. When we rightly subordinate under our love for God, then we can love in a fuller, richer way than we ever could have in any other kind of arrangement. So what I'm arguing for here is that a heart that is loving well tries to please its lover. And that's what Paul says. I have one aim. I do everything so that I might please God. Paul says he has that aim, whether he's at home or away from his tent. In the tent or away from the tent. He has that aim. See, what he's telling us here is that our life in the tent matters. Our life in the tent matters. It would be easy for us to think the tent's inferior, because it is, that the tent is fragile, because it is, that the tent is expendable, because it is. And last week, that's what we learned about clay pots, which is what Paul said this amazing gift has been given to, clay pots that are fragile, expendable, and inferior. So our tents are. And they are exactly the way God wants them for this season. Our life in the tent matters. As a result, he says, whether at home in the body or away from it, our goal is to please him. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive what is due him for the things done while in the body, whether good or bad. We have to be very careful with that verse. With verse 10, we have to be very careful. Because if we take that verse and we rip it out of context, we can turn the gospel into religion. And that would not be for our good. Let's do that. It means we're supposed to be careful. Let's rip it out of context. We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive what is due him for the things done while in the body, whether good or bad. Okay? We rip it out of context and just let it sit there. It means God is simply going to look at your life and give you what you deserve. That's exactly where we started. It's exactly where we started in the garden. I think it's completely true. Completely true. But a little more complex than what we're seeing if we rip it out of the context of the gospel. Okay, if we're going to hold the context together, we need to realize that the language is the same, and this is the same judgment seat that was in 1 Corinthians. And in 1 Corinthians, the context was on what one has built. And looking back and seeing what has been built and seeing God test it to see what it was. Okay? That's very similar to what's happening here. So he's talking about things done in the tent, things done in the now, being tested, being judged, the same judgment seat that that was being talked about in 1 Corinthians. In 1 Corinthians, some of the works that were done were tested and approved. Some of the works that were done were tested and shown to be worthless. It says that the life of the worker was spared, even though the works had no value. And some of the workers were told to depart because they were described as evil. So with that picture informing what we have right here, and remembering that the context is Paul's bold speaking, and realizing that it's in the context of Paul saying, I have confidence. As a matter of fact, I'm going to repeat it again. I have confidence. And at the beginning, he said, I do not lose heart. Paul was not worried about this judgment. He was sober about it, but he was not worried about it. As the passage unfolds, it's not an oh, be careful passage. It's a passage full of promise and full of assurance and full of the faithfulness of God. So, Paul is clearly telling us life in the tent matters. So don't grab hold of the promise and leave the tent behind. Because while you're in the tent, you're in the tent. While you're in this life, this is the life you have. You live it in a unique way because you have promise. You live it in a unique way because you have your eyes fixed on pleasing God. You live it in a unique way because there is such thing as judgment. So people will stand before this judgment, and they will stand there in the context of the ministry of reconciliation, the ministry of the delivering of the gospel to the lost and to the world. And next time I forget my papers, I'm learning how to make the machine not go to sleep, because it's driving me crazy. So the fear of God makes us sober. Going forward, reaching into next week's topic, since then we know what it is to fear God, we try to persuade men. Okay? Now, he didn't say, because we know what it is to fear God, we try to be good. He could have said that. He didn't say that. He said, because we know what it is to fear God, we try to persuade men. So the ministry of reconciliation makes us sober. We are sober as we receive it. Because we realize that to fail to receive it or to hold it away will mean that the promise of the eternal that God is promising would not be applied to us. Because he's applying it to those who receive the message of reconciliation. Secondly, it makes us sober as we deliver it. As we arrange our lives for the sake of taking that message to others, we are sober. It's like we're fearing God on behalf of others. Because of the consequences of not receiving it are so grave. It makes us sober. So we're sober as we receive it, we're sober as we deliver it, and we're always motivated by a desire to please God. Remember, I said I believe that is completely true. If we stand before the judgment seat and God says, I will now evaluate your life based on what you've done, nothing can measure up to him. He says, you see, I'm looking at this life. I'm not capricious. I'm just looking. Depart from me. Now, if we come before that judgment seat and Father says, oh, here's the life, show me what you've done with it. And if the first thing at the top of the evaluation is Jesus has kept the law on my behalf. And Jesus has given me a righteousness that I didn't earn for myself, then God evaluates based on that. And then, if we're in a situation where our lips say that, and God says, but I don't see any semblance of trying to please me. He says, I'm confused. Do you love me at all? I don't see you loving me at all. So, if you show no signs of loving me, do you love me? It's not a trick question. It's not a trick question. It simply shows everything is riding on what Jesus has done for us. And if we receive what Jesus has done for us, we will love God. We will try to please him because we love him. If we make intellectual statements without trying to love him, we're really playing a foolish game. Now, I'm not talking about a works salvation whatsoever. I'm simply talking about testing a heart to see what that heart has actually done. Now, that's sober. That makes us fear. Gotta remember, Paul isn't saying be afraid. He does say because we fear, but he doesn't say be afraid. he says, do not lose heart. He says, be confident. Be very confident. If you love God, you're living to please him. If you love God, this tent is going to be clothed with something much, much better. The call is for us to live wise here in the tent. While you're climbing the mountain with one aim, while we're living to please God, live wisely in this temporary structure that God has given you. We live now in a place we are visiting. We live in a place we're visiting. We're not yet living in our home. We're not yet living in the place of shalom, which is how Jewish people greet each other, because it means peace. But it also means the reason they greet each other with that is because it's a picture of the reign of God reigning, so that things are as they ought to be. It's the opposite of the place where sin has done damage. The place of shalom is where peace is reigning. And that's our destination. So we live now in a place where we're the visitors. We have a place to come that's our place of shalom, that's the place of our true home. The life we live in the tent matters. We're not just waiting to not be tented. The life we live in the tent matters. It is as much under God's reign of grace as our next home will be. It's not by accident. It's exactly what God has for us now. We are to live longing for the better. And we are to live secure because we have the promise. We don't even just have a promise. We have the down payment. We have a home that is secure.